Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Thursday, September 24th, 2015. It's just before 5 UTC as we are starting. I'm Sam Minter, and we do not have Yvonne Beau with us this week. He is once again traveling. He let me know just a few days ago. But we have Bruce Morton, who has joined us before as a co-host, joining us today.
Hello, hello.
It's great to have you again.
It's great to be back. I really enjoy being able to do this. Plus, it's whatever I can do to save you from doing a single show. I'm glad to do that. To spare your audience from your solo shows.
Yes, yes. So our big topics for today are going to be the Volkswagen situation. They got caught cheating. Of course, election 2016. Every week we got something on that. It'll be a strange week when we don't. And it's been a little while since we last talked about the situation in Syria, both what's going on in the country and the refugees. So we'll talk about that a little bit. But first, Bruce, anything else you wanted to sort of highlight in our little intro bit before we jump into things for real?
Well, it's always interesting to hear you all talk about your little things going on in your lives. I don't think your audience would be interested in things going on with me, but I find it interesting that you and Yvonne have little kids, and I've got a little kid too. I've got older kids too, but I have a little girl who's 4, mm-hmm. and she's been doing a home preschool here, and my wife Jennifer has been doing a good job teaching her and a whole bunch of other kids from our church here in our home. And so there were about 10 little kids in our house today. I was working from home today, and I could hear them downstairs all yelling and doing all kinds of fun things and tearing up the house. And it was funny because there was one little boy who was there drawing, and all of a sudden he just kind of broke into tears, kind of had like a little meltdown.
Yep.
Yeah, and it turned out she couldn't figure out what was going on. She's like, "What's going on? Did anyone hurt you or whatever?" Later on, she found out it was because he accidentally drew outside the lines.
Aww. Yeah, I can understand that feeling sometimes. That's cool. I can't imagine. I mean, my daughter is now doing part-time assistant work at my son's preschool, actually, and doing sort of the afternoon aftercare thing. And I can't imagine. I mean, I like kids. I like spending time with kids. But having a class of 10 4-year-olds just seems like I would get overwhelmed very quickly. You know, they have a yeah. lot of energy, and they have a lot of things going on, and so I respect the people who could do that. So along those lines, I'll mention one thing regarding school type stuff. My son is just missed the age cutoff. So he misses the age cutoff by 12 days. So he turned 6 12 days after the cutoff for when they determine grades and all that. And so he's just going into kindergarten now officially. Although he's been at a Montessori, so they've been doing things from all kinds of different levels. But, anyway, the point is, this year we decided that we're going to try to do a transitional thing to make it easier for him to transition into first grade later. And so the plan was to try
a schedule and consistency, and it's nice. Well, and especially with...
Sorry.
No, I have you back. Oh, no, I have you back. Something happened with my wired headset. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's okay. I'm like, wait. I was getting somebody else's conversation there. Weird. Anyway, I was just going to say that we had this plan of doing kindergarten is typically broken into half days. Sometimes you can get a full day program, but we were going to do half day at his old school, which also had a kindergarten, and half a day at the public schools to see, you know, give him a transitional period and see how he fares in the public schools and all this kind of stuff. And this plan, you know, to work well schedule wise, we needed to do the public school in the morning and his old school in the afternoon, and that would have made everything work out really nicely. And you know, we dealt with the schools over the summer and made sure we stated that we needed to do it that way on all the forms we filled out and all this kind of stuff. Of course, what did they do? They scheduled us so that the public school wants him in the afternoon, not in the morning, which of course threw our whole schedule into chaos in terms of, okay, how are we going to make this work? Who's going to cover what? How are we going to do when? But the more interesting part of this that I just wanted to mention on the public schools is, you know, we go in to talk to them about it and say, well, what happened? And there's several factors here. First of all, apparently they make the decision of morning or afternoon on a purely neighborhood-based basis. It's where you live. If you live in certain places, it's morning. If you live in certain other places, it's afternoon. And this is related to, like, scheduling buses and all of this kind of stuff. But even though, like, we wouldn't have been taking advantage of a bus, we would have driven him there. It didn't matter.
Well, don't they give you the option? They should be able to give you the option as long as you're willing to take them. Take your son.
No. They're like, we schedule the classes first based on the buses. And then what happens, and the other thing that sort of blew my mind in terms of, you know, organization and planning kinds of things, is they said, then what happens is on the first day of school, we see who actually shows up. Because invariably, they have people who didn't sign up for school show up, and people who did sign up for school not showing up. And so they apparently plan every single school year to spend the first few weeks of the school year shuffling the kids around to rebalance the classrooms. Because in this case, the way they had balanced things, they were actually significantly overfull on the morning classrooms. And so there was no room to, you know, transfer my son to the morning classroom because they all were already over the limits they were supposed to have. And they were like, well, we can't tell you. Maybe there'll be an opportunity. Maybe there won't be, because we might open another morning classroom to relieve this, or we might move some of the morning kids to afternoon. We don't know, because we're just going to have to wait to see how the first couple weeks play out.
You can also pay to have it be full day.
Yes, we could. But we wanted to do this thing where half the day he could be at his old school. And there was actually one slot left open for the full day option, but we didn't want to do that because we wanted to retain half the day at the old school. But anyway, my point is not like we ended up figuring out a way to make it work with the schedule that we were given. I mean, it's sort of a pain in the ass, but we figured out how to make it work. But what just boggled my mind, and it shouldn't boggle my mind, because I have memories of, like, this, you know, when my daughter was in that level of school, and for that matter, when I was in that level of school, of, you know, there being some degree of chaos and not great planning here. But it's just sort of the notion that, you know, you can't, first of all, you can't figure out the planning well enough so that you don't have a huge mismatch between your morning and afternoon classes, where, you know, the morning classes were, you know, well over 30 kids in the class, and the afternoon classes were like 25, and you weren't able to balance that out, and you don't have, and you, this sort of notion of, okay, well, we don't really know what's happening, and we're going to shift all the kids around for several weeks before it's finalized. Because, you know, you think about the experience for, you know, kindergarten, first, second, third grade, whatever, and you're basically, you throw them into a class and say, hey, meet all your new friends, and then a few days later, you're like, oh, never mind, we're going to switch you out. It's just...
That can be traumatic for a five-year-old.
Yeah, and it's like... really? You can't figure out a way to organize this better than that? And anyway, in the end, we're sort of working it out. And, you know, my kid's used to the pattern now, so we're probably going to stick with it for a while. But it's still the stress that it caused in the first few weeks, as we're like, oh no, how are we going to make this work? How do we shuffle things around? You know, we clearly requested, you know, this schedule, and we were never told over the summer when we were requesting the schedule that, yeah, that's not going to happen. It's just, anyway, frustrating stuff, but I suspect it's going to be the beginning of many years of frustrating butting heads with school systems. But anyway, fun stuff.
Yeah.
That's enough for that. Let's take a break, and we'll come back and we'll probably start it out with Volkswagen. We will be back after this. Okay, we're back. And you know, I think I'm getting another little cold or allergies or something. It's annoying, but so if you hear me cough, that's what's up. So Volkswagen. So the bottom line, I guess, is they were caught with several of their diesel vehicles basically having programmed into the car computers logic that tried to detect
it's almost all their diesel vehicles.
Yeah, I believe
they call so. Smart diesel.
Yeah, so it detects when the vehicle is undergoing an emissions test and changes the profile of how the vehicle reacts, so that it will pass those tests with good numbers, and then as soon as it detects the test is done, it shuts off all those systems. And emissions go up, in some cases, to 40 times the legal limit, and stay that way the whole time you're driving under normal conditions.
Yeah.
And so,
as an engineer, I can totally see how this could happen. I can imagine being in the meeting where they were making this decision.
So, you know, I can imagine it too, where you're sort of having the conversation and saying, well, it doesn't really matter what our emissions are most of the time. The only thing that matters is our emissions during the test, right?
Yep.
But at the same time, you got to think, how many levels does that have to go through at a company like this, you know, before it actually goes live? I mean, this isn't like, there's no way this is just like some rogue engineers in a room that didn't have management buy-in on this, is there?
Oh, no. This had to have been bought, maybe not at the top level, but definitely this was not just a lone engineer's issue or a solution.
I mean,
yeah, this is I can imagine this could have even been a cost reduction, because their competitors have to do a lot of things to be able to meet those emission requirements. They have to use what's called like this urea system, where you have to, it's like this alternate tank, which is used, which absorbs the that nitrogen or whatever
nitrous oxide, emission. I believe.
Yeah.
And. Yeah, I mean, it's clearly there were cost versus performance versus emissions trade-offs, and you know, they would have to do a lot of other stuff in order to be able to have anywhere near the performance they have. I mean, if I remember right, some of the advertising here was all about how, hey, look, we've got performance and eco-friendly in the same package. And, you know, yep. It turns out, well, how'd you get it? Well, by cheating.
Not the same time.
Yeah. Well, now, and that was actually one of my questions was, you know, and presumably, I guess they're being prosecuted for this now. So I guess the regulations actually were written in such a way that this was actually a violation. Because I could easily imagine, you know, the, you know, regulations actually being written as you have to pass this test without saying anything about what you do the rest of the time. The fact that they're going after them, I think, indicates that they probably the regulations were written in such a way that this actually was a violation of the rules, not just a violation of the spirit of the rules, but of the actual rules. But even more to the point, I mean, because you can argue about the specific regulations, but, you know, it's also just plain fraudulent because their whole marketing for these cars was based on, you know, them being eco-friendly in all these different ways. So you don't just have regulators upset. You've got a lot of people who bought these cars really upset, saying that
the solution for this is not going to be. It's going to make those owners very unhappy, no matter what they do, because there's two solutions. Well, there's three. One is a software fix. Second would be to add that extra hardware, that extra tank would use up some.
Well, the problem with the software fix, if presumably the software fix is, you know, make it operate the way it did for the tests all the time, then you kill the performance of the cars.
Exactly. And then if they do the tank thing, that's going to be super expensive to add that hardware to those. What I think hundreds of thousands of cars.
Yep.
And not only the labor, but the materials and the inconvenience for the owners to have to take their cars in.
And that's also assuming, this may or may not be the case. I don't know, but it's assuming that the way design is in place, there is a way that you can fit in the retrofit easily. You know.
Yeah. Who knows if that's going to be even possible. Well, I'm sure it'll be possible, but it's just a matter of cost and labor. But then the other thing is the third thing is for people to just not do anything. But that it's going to be a required recall. You know how when you get the recall notices in the mail for your cars, it's like most of I read today that 60-something% of recalls never even get implemented because people just don't bother to take their cars in.
Yeah, there are all kinds of different levels of recalls. I remember not in my current car, but in the car I had before, about 5 years into me owning the car, there was a recall, and the action for the recall was that the dealership had to add an additional warning sticker. And put it on the sun visor or something about the proper way to use airbags or something. And it was just they put a new sticker over the old sticker, and that was the recall.
Oh, that's silly.
Because
they're saying that since this will be a required change, that it will be that people will be able to get their emissions test done, or they won't be able to sell their car because the government will be checking on all these cars to make sure that the fix actually went in.
Right. Yeah, because of course the other fix we mentioned is, of course, you do a software change to not change it into emissions passing mode, but in that case it fails all the emission tests and people aren't allowed to keep them on the road.
Yeah.
Or have to pay huge fines or whatever the penalty is.
You know, now that I think of it, I bet you there's going to be a gray market for bootleg software. There's going to be a lot of users that are going to go in, get the recall. They're going to hate the performance, and then they're going to do a Google search on how to put their car back to the old performance. And there's going to be people out there selling a way to fix this to make it go back.
I am sure you are 100% correct on that. There's no way to avoid that. The one thing that's funny about this though is that one of the things that makes it hard to discover these problems and you know to that is an obstacle to those kinds of patches is that the automakers have been very strong in terms of trying to enforce the laws like the DMCA that prohibit reverse engineering of copyright protected things to cover the programming of their car computers.
Yeah, but then also in the news, cars have been notoriously insecure.
Yes. And well, in part for exactly that kind of reason, because they don't let people inspect them and tear them apart and try to break them. And, you know, whenever somebody does, they try to go after them. Because, you know, that kind of inspection is part of the feedback loop that lets you make things safer and more secure. And without that, you know, you get... the people doing it in secret are still going to do it. But you don't necessarily get that feedback and the public awareness that lets you, you fix those kinds of things. There will absolutely positively be about black market and these kinds of things. And, I'm sure there's already a world out there of sort of, you know, performance hackers who mess around in the computers on cars to try to tweak them in various ways. You know, and this is just part of that ball game. Volkswagen is, you know, this is going to cost them a huge amount. I mean, there've been,
well, it already has.
Yeah.
The stock down 20%.
The stock is down 20%. There's talk of $18 billion in potential fines. There's, a new sort of class action lawsuit being filed every day in terms of this kind of stuff. You've got, including, you know, some of the buyers, they're not probably not going to get this, but like the buyers in their lawsuits are trying to say, you know, what they actually want is for Volkswagen to buy their cars back at the original purchase price.
Oh, man. that would put them out of business.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not likely to go quite that far, but I mean, but people are out for blood here, and the CEO just resigned today, saying he wants to make room for somebody else to come in and fix this mess because he's not the right one to do it. It's one of these things where, again, you back to like being in the room where they made this decision. It's like, really? What was the thought process that no one would ever catch on that this was happening? Or was the thought process that there's nothing wrong with this? I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. All I can think of is that they probably thought that they would never get caught, because, you know, what happens is the engineers, and I see this in what I do too, is the engineers who design the product are not the same engineers who get it through the certification process.
Right.
And so I can see how the engineers who are trying to get the car certified, they go to the design engineers and they say, hey, look, it's not passing. We need a fix. And typical of engineering, the typical problem engineers are given are, fix the problem, but don't make any changes.
Yeah, because that works.
And believe me, it happens all the time. I was just down in San Diego last week to fix an issue, it was the same sort of thing. Fix the problem, but don't make any changes. And fortunately, it was a software problem. It kept thinking it was a hardware problem, but fortunately, if it's a software problem, it can be fixed with software, and so I can breathe a sigh of relief. But in this case, they fixed a hardware problem with software, but it really wasn't a problem. It was a flaw. It wasn't a bug. It was a design flaw.
Actual hardware in this case, the car itself, was not actually designed to pass the emissions tests.
Exactly. Yeah.
At least not with an acceptable performance trade-off. And so there they go. And Oh man, you always look at these decisions in retrospect, certainly, and you're like, well, what the hell were they thinking? But yeah, you can see the process, that this thought process that leads there, and you can even say, you know, people saying, oh, the problem that we have to solve is passing the test, as opposed to the problem that we have to solve is actually have the low emissions with good performance. No, that's not the problem. The problem is passing the test. This solution passes the test.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Anyway, we'll see how it all plays out. But yeah, Volkswagen is hurting pretty bad. Of course, there's a lot of reserves there. It's a big company. They've got a lot going on. It is probably not going to be the end of Volkswagen. But you know, if you see this kind of thing spiral out of control, you know, things sometimes spiral. But most likely, they're going to take a big hit. They're going to lose a lot in reputation, and in a few years, they'll bounce back.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Okay, that's it for Volkswagen. Let's take another break, and let's actually do Syria next, and then we'll end up with the election. Back after this. Well, and then probably a lightning round. We'll be back after this. Yeah.
This is a break, oh yes, this is a break. This is a break, cause no one gave me any suggestions. I warned you, so this is a break. This is a wonderful break, a wonderful break. Yes, indeed, this is a break. This is a break in the middle of Curmudgeon's Corner. Yes, this is a break. Yes, this is a break. Break, 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 break. Yes, this is a break. Yes, this is a break. Break, 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 break. Yes, it is a break. And now the break is over.
Okay, we are back. Now, Bruce, you'd actually brought this up as something to talk about. It actually dropped off my list. I'd had Syria on my list a couple weeks ago, but there have been some new developments in the last week or two. Do you want to mention some of them? I mean, the Russians are doing some stuff. The refugees are, you know, more stuff's going on there. What is there to highlight here?
Well, there you go. That's basically it. So the Syrian refugee crisis, and this is really just not just a Syrian refugee crisis. There's refugees from all over North Africa, particularly Libya, continuing to go across the Mediterranean, and Syrians, and I would imagine there's Iraqis also.
Yeah.
And Jordanians, maybe. I mean, I'm not sure about Jordanians, but trying to get through to Europe, because Europe has been very accepting of, particularly Germany has been very accepting of refugees, and there's various reasons for that. Partly maybe because of their falling population, they need to have young workers to keep their economy going, and also the fact that once you get into the Eurozone, it's what's called this, I think it's called the Schengen region or Schengen territory, where basically the borders of the Eurozone are gone now.
Right.
There's no limits whatsoever. Once you get inside, it's like Europe is all just one big country.
Right. Because they basically made the borders almost completely porous. I understand there's still some technical restrictions in certain situations, but for the most part, once you're inside that zone, you can travel freely.
Yeah, and so the shocking thing was when Germany got to the point where they said, okay, that's it, and they actually shut their borders, which is quite shocking. It's like, wait, the borders are gone. So I guess they re-erected them, at least in the places where the Syrians were getting in, or the refugees were getting in. But I would think that that's got to be a super porous border at this point, because these refugees are bringing their phones with them, and people are providing Wi-Fi for them to be able to communicate with each other. And so they're using multiple routes. They're, you know, if they can't get in one way, they tell their friends. And then they go in another way. And so these refugees are spreading out and trying all these different routes, and they're leaving they're leaving a mess what they're going through, but I don't think that's the main problem that can be cleaned up. But I think there's a lot of people in America are looking at that and going, oh no, they're going to try and get over here. And then President Obama has announced that we'll be accepting, I think, 85,000 this year and another 100,000 over the next 100,000 a year over the next 2 years.
Is it that high? I'd heard some preliminary numbers that were lower, but I think you're right that they were raised again after that. So I mean, whatever the exact number is, it's a large number of people. One interesting thing before we get into the potential impact of you know, large numbers of immigrants either on Europe or the U.S. Is that the initial point where most of these folks, especially Syria, there's huge encampments in Turkey. And so the question has been asked, well, why can't they make a life in Turkey? And the answer is that unlike the European countries, the Turkish folks have basically said, you can have sanctuary here. You can have a place. We're going to set up the refugee camps or whatever. But we are not going to allow anybody, essentially, to, you know, set up a life here. We're not going to let you work. We're not going to let you apply for, you know, services. We're not going to let you go to school. We're not going to let you do this, whatever. All the things that would potentially enable some of these refugees to sort of leave the refugee camp and, you know, go get a job another thing on the list they couldn't do was like rent an apartment, things like that. And so all of the things that you would expect somebody to do if they were like, okay, let's make a new life here, Turkey is not allowing. And so that's why a lot of these folks, and I heard a number of interviews on the radio of people, you know, who are asked that precise question, well, can't you stay in Turkey? And they're like, you know, no, it's horrible here in Turkey. It's basically, you know, it's just a camp. We can't do anything. There's no future here. So we're looking for a place where we can have a future. And that's why we're looking to move on to Europe or to somewhere else. And that's why they're willing to, I mean, when we saw those, you know, the pictures of the people drowning, that one kid in particular that, you know, raised the profile of this, but also, you know, there were many people dying, drowning, trying to get across the Mediterranean going back months and years all the time. When you see those pictures, many of them aren't of people leaving Libya and trying to go directly to Italy or whatever, although there are some of those. A lot of them are leaving Turkey trying to get to Europe.
And the thing that's confusing to me is, why are they going to Greece? I mean, there are islands of Greece that are just off of Turkey. In fact, you can see some of those islands in Greece from Turkey. But still, why are they crossing the water? You can drive to Europe from Turkey. Istanbul has a bridge over the strait that goes into the Black Sea. And I just don't understand why Turkey doesn't let them just go to the border of Bulgaria or even the border of Greece and walk over rather than risking their lives.
I think that's a very good question. I presume it has to do with, you know, the borders on the other side, being somewhat closed and, you know, same kind of, things we had with Cuba, where like there wasn't a legal method to get across, but, oh, if you manage to actually get here, then maybe we'll help you. And it does seem like a counterproductive policy, but as you mentioned, with Europe opening up and saying, okay, we're going to take a bunch of people, well, then a lot of these people in the refugee camps in Turkey and elsewhere are like, here's our chance, let's go. They were fairly overwhelmed by the huge numbers of people trying to get there. And so you've got of course, the trade-off in here, and you know, we've talked before that there's, you know, these are people who really are in many cases in desperate need, and so you want to help them, you want to do something here, but on the other hand, there is a reality that says, okay, if 1.5 million people show up in a week, what are you going to do? You know?
Yeah, it's, I think, give them temporary aid, but then, I'd say let them come into the country and see if they can integrate. There's a lot of, I'm sure if you watch Fox News, there's people all up in arms about the fact that Obama is going to let some refugees come in. But, you know, in the early 70s, we let in over 1 million Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
and they integrated just fine. In fact, they've been a great addition to America, and I would think the same thing of the Syrians. And
yeah, and there have been a lot of studies in that particular case that, you know, those people who came across in that wave of immigration ended up not being a burden on society. Like, people worried about, oh, they're gonna, you know, just take all the welfare and we're gonna end up paying for them and all that kind of stuff. Not only did that not happen, they are above average as a group. Obviously, you know, there's a wide range mm-hmm. within a group, but, you know, as a group, they have been a net positive in almost every measurement you can take, and yeah. frankly, this has been true of most immigrant communities, regardless of where they were coming from or under what circumstances. But I think you're right there. I mean, I think the right thing to do probably is, you know, let in as many of them as you possibly can and see how they do. But, you know,
and of course,
a lot of people
out there thinking that there's terrorists in there and that they're going to start enforcing their Sharia law in America, which I think is all bigoted and xenophobic mm-hmm. and racist.
I think you're absolutely right there. I mean, honestly, if you've got millions of people, I'm sure there are some people in that group who would fit the categories you're describing, but it's not the majority. It's not a large number. Most people just want to get on with their lives and figure out something and do better. You know, and if you do have an occasional problem like that, you deal with it, you know,
yeah.
But you don't sort of say no to the entire group of people in need because you've got some fear that
because there might be a criminal among them.
There might be a criminal among them, or, you know, like you said, just the sort of fundamental xenophobic, racist, religious bigotry, whatever, that, you know, says, oh my God, they're Muslim, we don't want any more Muslims, you know, or whatever. And people just need to get over that.
I totally agree. But I'm unfortunately, I think that view is a strong minority. As we get in on the next topic, you know, one of the candidates has said something about Muslims, and he's actually gained popularity. But we'll be talking about
We'll talk about that in a few minutes. Moving past the refugee situation for the moment. The other development has basically been Russian escalation in the region.
The Russians are coming.
the Russians have been moving in a variety of military hardware and basically have been positioning themselves to help further. I mean, they've always supported Assad, but they're ramping up the level of their military, specifically engagement, mm-hmm. to help prop up Assad's government there.
It's interesting to watch the news. Because in the news, you see them, well, the Russians are coming to prop up Assad. And you hardly hear them mention, or if at all, that, no, they're going in to fight ISIS.
Right.
Oh, well, thank you, Putin. We'll be fighting together. The Russians will be on the ground, and we'll be in the air. It's seen as the Russians gaining influence all over the territory and trying to mold and influence the territory and gain a foothold. Well, what have we been doing there for the last 100 years?
Yeah, well, and specifically, even just within the last few months, I mean, it's not like we're not in there militarily. There was, I remember laughing a couple weeks ago because there was a headline about a new secret CIA program to bomb high value targets in Syria, and it's like on the front page of the paper, it's like. Great secret there, but yeah, we're in there. We've had some limited troops on the ground in Syria as well as Iraq. We've been in there with drones. We've been in there with fighter planes. You know, we've been, you know, the quote unquote arming the rebels kind of stuff. We're fully engaged in there. And, you know, so it's so hypocritical to be like, the Russians are, that's bad, you know? And if you're looking at this from the point of view of, you know, Russian versus American influence in Syria, I think you're fundamentally coming at it from the wrong place to begin with. I mean, can you maybe think about it for 5 minutes from the point of view of like, you know, what's actually best for the Syrians, you know? And I don't think there's a lot of that going on, you know, as with all generalizations, I'm sure there's some, but, I mean, even in terms of the, and you know, Ivan and I talked about this, in recent weeks, but even in terms of the Assad must go, you know, as bad as Assad has been in certain areas, you know, the country was a lot more stable and safer when he did have his iron fist on the whole country. You know?
Yeah. I'm so surprised that Israel would even for what's going on there, you know, with our efforts to overthrow him, because he has not attacked Israel.
Right.
Israel has occupied a portion of Syria's sovereign territory for the last, 45 years?
Something like
46
that.
46 years. And he hasn't gone in and demanded or tried to invade that back. You think that...
Well, nothing more than sort of, you know, showy things. Nothing serious. I mean, there have been a few skirmishes over that border. But yeah, I mean, if from the point of view of... you know, stability of the country, stability of the region, whatever, propping up Assad wasn't necessarily the worst possible thing here, especially if there really wasn't a viable alternative, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because all of the stuff about, like, finding the nice rebels or whatever. I mean, you know, basically
the mythical moderates.
Yeah, the mythical moderates. I mean, basically, the war in Syria is a three-pronged war between Assad, Al Qaeda, and ISIS. You know, and by the way, a whole bunch of completely innocent Syrians caught in a crossfire. But none of those three groups are, you know, are angels here. Far worse, you know, and our meddling has not made anything better in any way, shape, or form. And I mean, I'm repeating stuff I've said on this show before. I think the whole area would have been better off if we just said, okay, you know, whatever, we're hands off. You know, we will provide support for refugees that we will leave. We will provide humanitarian assistance, but we're not getting involved in the war. The war is an internal matter for Syria. Whatever happens, happens. You know, and we're not getting our hands dirty in that. We'll help where we can when people need it from a humanitarian point of view. And if anybody's serious about peace talks, maybe we can facilitate or something. But, you know, trying to get involved in sort of picking winners in this kind of thing is not particularly useful. Of course, there's been some talk that, of course, the real strategy here is essentially... actually the opposite of this is to keep the war going and let these three three groups that we hate, let them fight to the death, and if it looks like it's sort of petering out, you know, throw some fuel on the fire to keep them going. You know, and I hope that we're not really that cynical, and that's not really what we're doing, because, you know, the collateral damage from that is just huge.
Yeah, that's called human life. It's horrible.
Yeah.
And getting back to Russian, I think the good thing, though, is I'm not hearing anybody in the news, or at least anyone in power that in the U.S. that's saying we need to put boots on the ground to physically stop the Russians, to put another front on this war, to have it be the Russians versus...
Not even John McCain?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't listened to what he has to say.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't surprise me if he were to say, oh, we need to go and invade to push the Russians out. That would be dumb. So all I'm hearing is, from what I saw on the news reports, is that Obama's just saying to the Russians, please don't do that, but with no...
Well, there has been a lot of criticism of Obama for essentially just saying, oh, please don't, with nothing backing it up. But there hasn't been a lot of, well, exactly what would you do instead? You know, because if you're talking about going beyond saying, you know, hey, let's talk about this, let's perhaps do something else, then you're talking about trying to stop them. And if you're talking about trying to stop them, you're talking about being on a war footing with Russia, you know? And so people sort of tend to, you know, do the criticism of Obama for not being more forceful without ever specifying, you know, well, exactly what would you do instead? I mean, come on. And there has been, you know, one of the reports in the aftermath of this also was that that we are opening up, you know, military to military communications between us and the Russians, basically to coordinate, without saying this explicitly, we are coordinating our efforts in that battlefield. Because we want to continue to fight ISIS, we want them to do whatever they're doing, and we would like to not accidentally attack each other.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing to do it on purpose, but we're trying to avoid doing it accidentally. And so there is coordination between the Russians and the American militaries in Syria.
If that's true, then I think that's really good.
Officially what's been said is it's basically just sort of the minimum required to, you know, like I said, avoid accidents where the two clash with each other. But you hope and you cross your fingers that there's actually more to it than that. And there actually is some coordinated planning on places where there are common objectives. That would only make sense.
This makes me think of what's going on the other side of the border in the Iraq side we're coordinating with Iran.
Yeah, I was about to mention that, because that the same kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge thing is going on there where, no, we're not coordinating with Iran. We're not cooperating. It just happens that we'll mention these things that allow us to, you know, not bump into each other and maybe sometimes attack the same people.
You know? Well, we're basically being Iran's air force there in Iraq. So
yeah. You know. And anyway, interesting stuff. I think we've exhausted Syria for the moment. Let's take another break, and we'll talk about the election and all the surrounding politics. Back after this. Hey, we know when you listen to this show, you have thoughts about what we say. You probably want to vent about what we got wrong or what we left out, right? Or maybe you want to suggest some future topics we just haven't gotten to yet. Well, then, tell us all about it. Right now, there are four ways to get feedback to us. First, you can go to the Curmudgeon's Corner Facebook page and leave comments on the post where we announce all the new episodes. Second, you could go to curmudgeonscorner.com, that's with a hyphen, and leave a comment there instead. Third, both Yvonne and I are on Twitter. You can talk to me at Abulsme, A-B-U-L-S-M-E, or Yvonne at I-M-B-O-U. Finally, if you don't want to make your comments in a public forum like that, just email me directly at abulsme@abulsme.com. Again, that's A-B-U-L-S-M-E. But, you know, if you don't want us to mention your feedback on the show, be sure to say so, because otherwise, we're probably going to respond to your comments on a future show.
because, you know, that's what makes the discussion. Thanks, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Okay, we are back yet again. And we're going to talk about election 2016. There have been a lot of developments here. I've got a bunch of things on my list. But Bruce, before we get into the rest of it, I just wanted to start with, I know you're a Rand Paul supporter. How do you think about how that's been going so far? Because my impression is he hasn't been doing as well as he wanted to be doing at this point.
Yeah, it's been very disappointing. Yeah, it's been disappointing. You think that that he would be well positioned with the with his position on the rock, and that being more acceptable to avoid conflict, but it just shows that people want someone who's an outsider. The top three are the ones who have never been in an election, and even this, his one term in the Senate may be seen as too much of an insider.
Well, and I think, the other thing that, I mean, I'd been predicting since the 2012 election that, you know, Rand would run. And my prediction was that, you know, 2016 wouldn't be his year to win the nomination, but he'd do better than his father did in 2012 and maybe position himself for 2020. That was my prediction.
Oh, I don't even think that's the case.
Yeah, and I don't think that's happening. I think what's happening is he is not fully capturing the folks that supported his father. And he's, you know, he'd been planning, the plan was always to sort of also get some other people from the Republican Party. But the mood in the party seems to be, like you said, outsider only, and that might be a factor. Although you can sort of, you can sort of kind of classify him as an outsider, even though he's in the Senate, because he goes against the rest of his party so much in this kind of stuff. Yeah. But at the same time, I had thought the libertarian wing of the Republican Party was growing as sort of the millennials started to age into the party and people with more of that mindset came up, but it's not looking like that. It's looking like that faction is actually shrinking, and some of these the Republican Party is retrenching into, you know, the religious and social conservative type folks. I mean, even the fiscal conservatives and the sort of business conservatives feel like they're getting squeezed out for the radical social conservatives and you mentioned it before, sort of the xenophobic racist wing of the party.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say that I think that there are a large number of xenophobic, bigoted racists in the Republican Party. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people who are just going to say that's so wrong. Well, you know what? I've been involved in the Republican Party since 2008, and that's I see that all over the place. And they cloak it in the term of, oh, we want to protect our borders. We have to protect our culture. Oh, we want to protect our religion. I think it's just racism and bigotry. And it comes in the form of war against them, because we want to fight them over there before they come over here. Because no, we would never want to let them come over here. I think if it weren't for all the foreign stuff that's going on, all the stuff going on in the Middle East, if ISIS hadn't flared up, I think Rand would be doing a lot better. Because when it comes to the domestic stuff, I think people really agree with him, like they agree with his father, about, you know, shrinking the size of government and standing our ground on spending and taxes and things like that. But that's just not the situation right now. And so you see people, those who are ahead speaking about, out against Muslims and all. But yeah, I'm still trying to get Rand elected. with regard to the state within the state of Washington, it's a crazy situation where Republicans are going to allocate their delegates according to the primary. And the primary, as it stands right now, is scheduled to occur after the Republican state convention.
Yes.
So we will have selected all of our delegates that go to the national convention, but they will be bound to the primary, which they won't even know what the results are, which
right.
is crazy.
Yeah, and so the idea behind that kind of structure is, unlike a pure caucus state where you are, you know, electing people who support a certain candidate to go on to the next stage and eventually become delegates to the convention, this kind of structure is designed to elect and choose the delegates to just be, you know, party people who aren't necessarily particularly loyal to a particular candidate, because it doesn't matter who they're loyal to, because the rules bind them and, in fact, have all kinds of exceptions in place. I mean, even at the national convention, part of the rules that the Republican Party adopted allow, even at the point of the roll call vote at the convention, if somebody votes in a way other than they were supposed to vote, the vote can be disallowed and replaced by what they were supposed to do.
Yeah,
know, and so you're.
And that's why we're so hoping for a where they have a second vote.
A brokered convention.
A brokered convention, exactly.
Yeah, because basically
that's when they're free.
Like, once you get past a first ballot, if you need a second ballot, then all of the delegates can do whatever they want. But it's but that's also why the structure of everything is and in more and more states is designed to elect delegates who, you know, are party insiders first and foremost, so you won't get surprises. Now, whether or not that'll work out or not when we get there, I mean, there's still 50 different states plus some territories of different rules. It's not a unified national rule set. So it'll be interesting how that all plays out if you actually get to a scenario where that matters. but they're trying to structure it as much as possible to avoid surprises.
Yeah. It may blow up in their faces, actually. If they end up with a brokered convention between Fiorina and Trump, it would... on that second vote, all those party loyalists would then vote for Bush.
Yeah.
Disenfranchising all those voters.
That's why they say sort of the party decides. There are all these structures in place to basically make the primary and caucus process eventually end up with who the party insiders wanted anyway. We'll see how that goes. But I could also see a scenario where if you end up hitting the convention with without a clear majority, it's just going to be total chaos, and you're not going to actually get. I don't think you'd end up with a candidate that, you know, most of those people at the convention are actually going to go home happy with. There's going to be a lot of grumbling, and that's the scenario that leads to the worst possible result for the party in the general election, I think. And of course, if you get, I've talked about these are all the dream scenarios for junkies like me that never actually happen. But, you know, you could see something like Trump actually does win the GOP nomination, but then, you know, Rubio or somebody says, this is unacceptable, I'm running third party.
But I could very much do that.
But anyway, so we do have a few things here that happened specifically in the last week or so, and you alluded to one in the last segment, which was Carson's comments about Muslims and what's happened after that. So you want to elaborate a little bit?
So I don't know too much about it. I've basically just seen the headlines about, apparently Carson said that he doesn't believe a Muslim would be qualified to become president. And so lot of people have been saying, well, that's very bigoted, and that's actually specifically against the Constitution.
Well, the one thing that he said, and I don't agree with Carson at all in his general point, but I will grant that his original statement was actually fairly carefully worded, that he would not advocate for a Muslim president because he thought that situation would be inconsistent with the Constitution, which does not mean he thinks the Constitution does not allow for a Muslim president. What he was saying, and he further clarified his remarks later, was that, you know, if someone truly believes in sort of fundamentalist Islam and you must apply Sharia law, then he didn't think that person could effectively implement the Constitution and fulfill their duties. But of course, that's not how it came across. And I think, you know, in the end, you know, he is clearly, you know, bigoted here, but, you know, then you did have a lot of people say, look, the Constitution requires no religious test. Of course, a Muslim can become president. There are all kinds of, you know, Muslims who serve in our military, who serve in Congress, who, you know, et cetera. And, you know, and Carson tried to clarify, well, maybe there might be some good Muslims out there. I don't know, but you know,
yeah. And this just confirms what I mentioned earlier about how the Republican Party really is the party of xenophobic, bigoted, racist people. And so the money has been pouring in for Carson in the last few days because of that.
Yep. And you know, the other thing that's been brought up, and I forget who said this, but I thought it was fairly insightful, that it's also coded because it's not just conversations about some potentially hypothetical Muslim candidate in the future, because, you know, the Constitution is clear. There's no religious test, et cetera, et cetera. It's coded for, hey guys, we already have a Muslim in the White House and it's not working out that well.
Oh, gee. Because, yeah, and I see that on Facebook every once in a while. And whenever I see someone saying, oh, Obama's Muslim, I point out that, wow, for a Muslim, he sure has killed a lot of his own people.
I mean, it's not only that, but I mean, you know, I get frustrated on all of those. Whenever you even get into the conversation, you know, with any answer other than, well, if he was, so what? You know, let's talk about his views and what he's advocating for and whether you like that or not. You know, if he was a Muslim, oh, well, you know. Now, it's a completely different thing if he actually was jumping up and down and saying we must apply Sharia law to the United States or anything like that. But nobody's really doing that. I mean, it's the people who are worried about that are, you know, in their own little universe that's not really related to what's going on in real life, you know. I'm not particularly a person of faith myself. If I was worried about those things, I'd be like scared of those damn Christians, you know. But it in the end, you know, what someone's personal beliefs are only relevant insofar as they inform how they make decisions and what policies they advocate for and those kinds of things. And you can look at those things independently. Like, you know, if your faith makes you want to be a better person and do a certain set of policies that you think will be better for the country, okay, let's evaluate those policies and I'll see if I agree with you or not. I may come to agree or disagree with those policies from a completely different direction than you do, but as long as we end up at the same place, or you know, it doesn't matter how you got there to me. All of this is back to the sort of coding for, you know, they're bad because they're different, and it's not like the old traditional whatever. And so you're scared of the different religion, you're scared of the different nationality, you're scared of the fact that, you know, whatever. And and so you get Carson making comments like this, and of course a whole bunch of people rally and say, yeah, let's go. And it's the same thing behind Trump and his comments about Mexicans. It's just it's actually scary to me here, the numbers of people that are flocking to these messages. We're talking, if you add Trump and Carson up right now in the numbers, together they're about 50% of the Republican electorate.
Yep. And just so your listeners know where I'm coming from, I'm a very active Christian. I go to church every Sunday. And yet I totally endorse, you know, if Muslims want to practice their religion wherever, however they want, go right ahead. I have nothing against them.
Yeah. But,
yeah. So next thing, Walker dropped out this week.
Yes, Walker did drop out this week. And, you know, he had one of the more spectacular drops so far. I mean, Bush is following right behind him at the moment, but Walker was, doing very well.
He was a front runner at one point.
I'm trying to look back. It looks like for a brief period, somewhere around March or April was the time he was actually ahead number one, but he was number two for, you know, a significant part of the year, behind Bush usually. But then he's been, you know, since about July, I mean, back in July, he was still at like 12, 13, 14%, in these national Republican polls. And then at the moment he was dropping out, I mean, he was down to less than 1.5%. And in some polls, he wasn't even registering.
Yeah, he's not able to make any waves. It's like at the last debate, I didn't watch it, but I listened to it as y'all were commenting on it.
Yeah,
and I couldn't remember hardly anything. He must not have had much time, had anything to say memorable.
In some of the some people did do the analysis of how much time everybody had in the debate. And I don't have it handy, but he had the least of all the candidates up there.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Like, in that 3 hours, he talked, like, 6 minutes.
Wow.
Compared to, I think, like, Trump got, like, 20 minutes out of the 3 hours.
And so the benefit... So since that debate, there's been a change in the polling. Mm-hmm. And Trump and Carson have gone down a bit.
Yep.
And in place of them have been Fiorina and Rubio have shot up a bit. And so now, at least according to the polling that I've seen, Bush is in fifth place.
Yep. I mean, it depends how you do the averaging on the one Yvonne and I look at the most is Real Clear Politics, because it's nice and easy. Fiorina and him are actually tied at 7.5% right now. But again, it all depends how you count.
That's on the average, though, right?
That's on the average. She's got the momentum right now. He's still heading down. Like if you look at the very most recent big national poll, it had, let's see, Trump 26%. This is Fox News's poll that came out yesterday, I think. Trump 26, Carson 18, Rubio and Fiorina tied at 9, Cruz at 8, and then Bush at 7. And then everybody else is like 5 or less.
Yeah.
And yeah, so... So you've got this interesting dynamic here. Now, we'll see how big these jumps end up being. Like, you know, there is still a big, big gap between Trump and Carson and Rubio, Fiorina, and Bush. Like, in the Real Clear Politics average right now, you know, Trump's at 28, Carson's at 19, then Rubio, Fiorina, and Bush are all rounding at 8%.
So then the real question is, will Trump continue to go down, and will Fiorina become the new front runner, or will Carson be able to hold on?
I think we're a long way from Fiorina coming to the top. I mean, you know, she's there's a big gap between Trump and Carson, and then Fiorina and Rubio. Now
she's got some skeletons in her closet that, you know, as soon as she starts getting some, being higher in the polls, she'll get some more scrutiny, and then all the, then maybe
right.
people will have second thoughts about her.
And, you know, today we've had, there was another little dust up between, Trump and Fox over some commentator basically saying that, Fiorina emasculated him in the debate, and, like, you know, Trump completely, you know, lost his cool over that and is boycotting Trump again, Fox again. And, you know, it's all like,
you know. Well, you know, what was funny about that, it was Trump said that he's boycotting Fox. And then Fox came out right afterwards and said, no, we had canceled him.
Yeah.
So he apparently, what may have happened is that Fox may have canceled Trump, but he wanted to jump out ahead of it.
Yep.
And say that he was boycotting them. It's kind of like the thing where, no, we're going to fire you. No, you're not firing me. I quit.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, you see these, and yeah, Trump and Carson have dipped a little bit, but they're still really high up there. You know, I'm not seeing, and you know, with the dynamics we've been talking about sort of these, the core groups of their supporters and why they like them. You know, I'm still not seeing, you know, a major collapse happening, at least not yet. I mean, events of next week may change everything, but you know, we're off the highs a little bit for these guys, but not by much. You've still got this interesting dynamic, and again, the fundamental that you add up these guys and you are almost at 50% means it's really tough. You know, I've talked before about let more people drop out, and then you'll have some consolidation against, you know, with one of the sort of more mainstream folks coming up. But right now, you add up all these little guys, you know, they're still not where Trump and Carson are. So you've, I don't know. I still think you are going to end up with, you know, one of the non-outsiders as the nominee, more likely than not. I mean, I'm not giving Trump or a 0% chance of winning the nomination, but I think it's a bigger chance that it does end up being like Rubio or somebody, like, or if you go for a more radical person, I don't know, maybe Cruz. But I still, you've got enough institutional resistance to a Trump or a Carson or whatever, that I think at some point they're just going to run into obstacles that, you know,
Rubio appears to be the establishment choice now.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody's sort of seeing Bush fizzle. I mean, and he's not been, you know, I said before, follow the money, follow the money, follow the money. The money is starting to look to where else they can go. Because Bush has fallen completely flat, you know, even amongst the audiences that you think would be receptive to him. And there's sort of the issue of, you know, the Republican Party as a whole has tended not to really want the moderates. They just end up settling for them. And Bush isn't really a moderate, but he has sort of a moderate persona. You know, but
well, he has some moderate views compared to the, you know,
compared to some of these guys in certain areas. But yeah, he hasn't caught on even amongst the groups you think would go for somebody like Bush. And he's ended up somehow stuck in the, I guess it's his opponents being smart and bringing it up all the time, but he's been stuck defending his brother over and over and over again, and not getting away from that. Like, I mean, it seems like if you were Jeb Bush and you really wanted to win this thing, you would be distancing yourself from W as hard as you could. But he's got the family loyalty thing going. He's defending his brother. He's saying that, you know, he's tying himself in knots in terms of doing that kind of thing. And so everybody's building that association. And that's, you know, his brother does not currently have like the best reputation in the world. It's up a little bit from its lows. But, you know, he did not end his presidency in a place where people loved him.
Even if people did, or some Republicans liked his policies or what he did, still they have to acknowledge that he set it up for the Democrats to be in power for a while, and set it up for Obama to be elected there.
Yeah. Okay. Let me see. Yeah. Go ahead.
So let's not just talk about the Republicans. There's stuff going on the Democrat side too, right?
Yeah.
The last couple of weeks.
And I was. Go ahead. I have one thing on my list.
We've got Bernie. Bernie has been jumping ahead. He's ahead of Clinton in both Iowa and New Hampshire, which is something that would be totally unheard of at the beginning of the year. Which actually pleases me, because that actually confirms one of my predictions at the beginning of the year.
Although, by the way, in the latest results in Iowa have Hillary pulling ahead again. But
you're right.
A little bit, just by a little bit. But in New Hampshire, Sanders is still clearly ahead, though. One of the things though is if you look, and this also brings up the question of, you know, the Iowa, New Hampshire monopoly of the beginnings. If you look nationally, Sanders is nowhere close to Clinton. And both Iowa and New Hampshire, you know, are very unrepresentative of the rest of the country in mm-hmm. all kinds of demographic and political ways. So you may have a scenario where, you know, maybe Bernie does hold it out and win these two, but Clinton is still able to pull it out because Sanders is so concentrated there that he doesn't get the traction elsewhere.
Isn't this the same way that Obama beat Hillary?
The counter narrative of that is exactly that, you know, before Iowa, you know, people were looking at Obama and said, hey, he's an interesting upstart. This is interesting, but, you know, he'll never be able to win Iowa, and he's not going to be able to win the nomination. Look at how much ahead Clinton is, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then he won Iowa, and everybody was like, oh, wait a second, he can actually win. And then a whole bunch of additional people flocked to him. Now, I don't have a really good memory of exactly what was going on in 2008 in front of me, but I think Clinton is still further ahead of Sanders than Obama was at a similar period. But you do have a similar dynamic going on there in terms of if Sanders does manage to win Iowa and New Hampshire, the narrative everywhere on the news and in people talking is, oh my God, Sanders is ahead. He's winning. He's da, 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 da. And you may see floodgates open of a whole bunch of people who weren't otherwise considering Sanders start to. And that's the dynamic that, you know, that the Clinton camp's got to be afraid of. But mm-hmm. you also have the dynamic that, you know, Sanders' organization elsewhere isn't necessarily as strong. There are all kinds of issues there. But, you know, the thing you got to keep looking at the same time is, it would be one thing if Clinton was, you know, fairly consistently being strong, and, you know, Sanders was, you know, maintaining 20% or whatever. But Clinton has been dropping precipitously, you know, for the last, you know, since the spring sometime, since April or May. You know, since then, she's been consistently going lower, 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 both in terms of the Democratic polls and also
because they've been throwing Biden into the ranks, though.
they have been throwing Biden in the mix. And one of the analysis that you do see is that if you take Biden out, this does not look as bad for Hillary. She's still had somewhat of a decline, but it doesn't look as bad. And of course, Biden's in the mix because he keeps saying, maybe I will, maybe I won't, maybe I will, maybe I won't. Now,
so speaking of that,
yep.
I did a little research to see, all right, when do these shadow candidates need to make their decision, namely Biden and Romney?
Yeah. Okay.
Because people are still thinking, including me, that Romney could come in as a white knight to kind of save the Republican Party from Donald Trump.
Although there are some polls that have included Romney in the last couple of weeks that show that if he was in the mix, he wouldn't be doing, you know, any better than Bush is right now. He'd be at that 6-7% mark.
Okay. Well, anyway, so I looked at the dates. The registration deadline for the South Carolina Republican primary is the September 30th, just a few days from now. But I could easily see the candidates just like skipping that because the next real deadline is not until November 10th. That's when the Texas primary is. And nobody is going to be able to skip the Texas primary. So that's the real. But if nobody else has jumped in by including,
I would actually not be so sure about that because although really? Texas is huge and has a large number of delegates, it's so late in the process that that essentially by the time you get there, the race is usually over. Texas usually doesn't matter. And it would take a weird set of events to make Texas matter. So I could see someone even strategically missing a state like Texas because the notion being that they build up such a lead in the states before you get to Texas that everybody's dropped out by then anyway.
So I don't have the rest of the dates in front of me, but I think that there's a whole bunch of other states that have their deadlines in November.
Yeah, no, I think that's correct. I think that's correct. But the other thing that people have talked about, though, is Biden's strategy, in many ways, it is only worth it for him to jump in if Hillary is collapsing. Because if you end up in a Hillary versus Biden fight, it's going to be potentially a real fight that's going to last a while.
So he's waiting for her to collapse completely.
Yeah. So, like, he could potentially say, like, you know, hell, he could wait until, you know, voting's already started in, you know, Iowa and New Hampshire are over. Maybe the right point for Biden to jump in, you know, is Iowa and New Hampshire are done. Sanders has won. Clinton looks incredibly vulnerable. And Biden's like, you know, I'm not on the ballot in many of these states, but let's see what we can do to elect unpledged delegates or vote for other or whatever. And we'll play games at the convention.
And who knows what will happen after these debates? Because, you know, Webb and O'Malley, and I forget who the other guy is. They may rock it on the debate.
Well, I suspect that O'Malley, Webb, and Chafee will see at least some sort of spike in their poll numbers after the first debate, simply because right now no one knows who the hell they are. You know, so they're at 1%, 1%, 0.4%. You know, it's like no one cares what they are. But once you actually see them on stage and they say something, they have at least the opportunity to make some points and make somebody say, you know, I never thought about that Webb guy, but, you know, he sounded okay. Now, from what little I've heard of these guys, when I have heard them give speeches or whatever, I haven't been particularly impressed, so I'm not sure they'll actually end up having that effect. But I think the debates are generally going to be dangerous for Clinton. I mean, even if it's just Clinton and Sanders that are seriously in contention, you know, we talked about what happens if Sanders wins Iowa and New Hampshire. You've got a mini version of that with the debates. If Sanders comes off well against Clinton, you know, he's going to see a big boost. And right now he doesn't need big a boost to be neck and neck with her, you know, and as soon as you get that, you know, I mean, she's already in trouble, you know, she should, you know, now I want to caveat that by saying that, you know, there have been a number of people, and 538 is one of them, who've looked at this situation and said, look, you know, yeah, she's well way down from where she was. But if you compare to 2008 or any other, you know, open election, she's in a better position of any Democratic non-incumbent in the modern era. Still, even with their declines recently. She's better off than she was in 2008, and she's better off than any of these other open elections, you know, where there've been a real race for the nomination. Now, but the trend is down. At some point, if she wants to be in a comfortable position, she has to stop falling. You know, if the polls stabilize right where they are right now, she's probably in a really good place. But the problem is that they haven't been stabilizing. She keeps going down and down and down and down.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I definitely want to watch that Democrat debate. Normally, I would not be watching that, but interesting to see.
And as I did a post in the last 24 hours as well, when in my general election polling, she's also been declining dramatically over the last few months, specifically against Bush and Rubio. Not quite as much
by the rest of the candidates. I saw your post on that.
Yeah, I mean, the other candidates over the last year have been gaining on her, but in the last few months, it was really only Bush and Rubio who were making gains against Clinton. But she's not doing great. She's still ahead, but she's ahead by a lot less than she looked to be a number of months ago.
Well, yeah, I was really surprised to see that the tipping point state for between her and Bush is North Carolina.
Yeah.
North Carolina is not a Democratic bastion. I mean, that's only like 2.5%. So really it's
like nothing. It's like nothing. The other Hillary thing I wanted to mention before we close up on this election stuff is there have been a couple reports in the last couple days. One, that the FBI has recovered a bunch of email from the server that she turned over.
They did not wipe it.
So they did not wipe it. And apparently, you know, look, there are two ways to look at it. One is the Clinton team was completely incompetent because they wanted to wipe the stuff and didn't know any better than just hitting the delete button. The other way to look at it is they weren't actually that concerned about it. And so it was just the lawyers hitting the delete button. They never actually engaged the IT group. And they really were just deleting the personal emails.
I think that they probably just never imagined the controversy and the firestorm that has occurred.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I think this the Clinton team's whole take on this from the very beginning has been this is a non-issue. This is not something that's important. Here are the relevant emails from when I was into State Department that maybe State Department should have had all along. Here you go. No problem. I removed the ones that weren't. I'm not giving you those. And they probably did honestly think that this is a big nothing. This is the State Department requesting some old records, and here you go. And didn't really think about it beyond that.
That's why everyone else has done it before.
Yeah, no, everybody else has done it that way before. And I mean, I sort of understand where that is. I mean, as Yvonne and I have talked about.
Well, not necessarily putting a server in their house. That's not what
this
has been done before.
No, not quite. It's still stupid. I mean, and it was stupid for all the other people before, but sort of the further back in time you go, the more you can sort of excuse people from, oh, email was new, they didn't know what they were doing, blah, blah, blah. But come on, we're talking about 2008, 2009, 2010 here. I guess starting in 2009, actually. By then, yeah. You should have an idea. And then there is the, you know, the certain of the things on there look like they should have been classified. Even if you take Clinton at her word that they weren't classified when she got them or sent them or whatever, you should have some sense of, this is sensitive information. Maybe it should be classified. But even then, it's sort of, you know, if anything, it reeks more of, you know, technological, just being very naive technologically, as opposed to something malicious that was going on. Now, if they end up uncovering some emails that actually are problematic, everything changes. But so far, to me, it's more, you know, showing that they were incompetent rather than showing that they were doing something bad per se. Having said that, incompetence is still a pretty bad indictment. You know, you don't want to elect an incompetent president or a president who doesn't have, you know, the right wherewithal to hire a team that is competent. But we'll see how that goes. The fact also that it's just every other week there's a new revelation about it is part of this problem for Hillary. If that stopped, if they were like, okay, this is done, she might start to recover. But as long as every week there's something new that they've dug up on Hillary and something that looks stupid or incompetent or, you know, to the right perspective, you know, like she's doing something shady, you know, that's going to keep hurting her. And her reactions to it have been exactly the reactions. If you had to design the reaction to make the situation worse, she's done it every single time. Anyway, enough about the election. Let's take a quick break and I don't know, maybe do a really quick lightning round. We'll be back after this.
Yeah, sounds good. Mm-hmm.
You're in the Valley, AM 1620 and LiganAirRadio.com. This is where you'll find your favorite songs. Everybody's doing a brand new dance now. Classic music for a classic American town, AM 1620, and in stereo at LiganAirRadio.com, The Valley.
Okay, we are back. So, Bruce,
let's make the true lightning round. Keep it to 2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay. Let me actually get up a timer. Haven't done this in a while. Probably should. But, okay. Well, while I get up the timer, Bruce, you think of what you're going to start with. We'll let you start.
Yep. I'm ready.
And we've got a 2 minute timer starting now. Go.
Okay. Supermoon eclipse coming this Sunday night. When you see the moon coming up on Sunday night, be sure to take a look because it's supposed to be red from the eclipse, and it's supposed to be 14% bigger because of it's at its closest point. I forget the official name of that in its orbit around the Earth, and something like that does not happen but for every 20-30 years. So the next one is supposed to happen in the year 2033. So.
And is it actually supposed to be visible over North America?
From what I saw, for us and on the West Coast, we will be catching the tail end of it.
Mm-hmm.
But on the East Coast, you'll be able to see it from the beginning.
Excellent. And I've also seen that in case you're in a place that's clouded over or you're not in a continent where you can see it, there are a number of places that are going to be streaming it online from telescopes and various other things to get a good view. Because, you know, where we live in Washington State, where Bruce and I live, it's often cloudy. Which makes it hard to see some of these astronomical events. But if it is cloudy and you're still interested, just search for it online. There are going to be numerous places that are doing live coverage, and we'll let you can put your computer screen on full screen and watch it that way. Although it's nicer to see it in person, of course.
I tell you, it's nice to, a good place to see it from around here is over, there's a riverfront park over in Everett, and you can watch the moon come up over the mountains, the Cascade Mountains.
Mm, excellent. Okay, I guess that makes it my turn. We just finished the 2 minutes. I guess I don't have a lot to say about this, but just to note, I guess 2 weeks ago now, Queen Elizabeth became the longest serving English monarch ever, beating out her great grandmother, Queen Victoria. You know, she's said she's not going to abdicate or anything like that, because I guess she just wants Charles never to become king, something like that. But but anyway, it's an interesting milestone to note. There were no big celebrations or anything like that. She insisted on it just being a regular day. And of course, you know, the queen has no real power at this point and hasn't had for a few generations. But there's just like with the U.S. system, there are all kinds of weird things where, you know, by practice, she doesn't do anything anymore. But technically speaking, she actually does have some powers if she ever chose to wield them. Although the reality is, if she did, there would no longer be a monarchy because they'd be done with that.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay, that's all I have to say about the queen. Your turn again, Bruce.
Okay, so last week, the Federal Reserve decided not to raise rates. And by the time they made that decision, there was not much surprise, because there had been a lot of talk that it would not be a good time to raise rates. And it's funny that at the beginning of the year, everyone was talking about how rates are going to go up because the economy seems to be doing better. And it's time for us to go to a more normal interest rate. There's always been some excuse. There's always been some sort of reason why not to. And I can understand why, because inflation is low and the dollar is strong. And if we were to raise rates, that would make the dollar stronger. And it would also make inflation go even lower. And so basically the Federal Reserve has can't really raise rates. Because of what's going on globally. And it makes me wonder, when are they ever going to raise rates? Because we've been in this situation for 7 years now. And if you look at a graph of interest rates for the last, 80 years or so, it's like the patient's dead. It's like flatlined at zero. So I think we've reached a new normal.
Yeah, well, and the other interesting thing, I've seen a number of graphs that show not just the actual interest rates, but every year the consensus economist predictions of where interest rates will go in the next few years. And the predictions are always going up, 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 and the actual interest rate has not. And it's like the people doing the predicting, you know, obviously are not actually doing any good prediction. They don't know.
Yeah.
They're just saying what they want to happen.
So I don't think the Fed's going to raise rates until they're forced to. And what that means is when if there's a big spike in inflation or,
Well, I mean, part of the goals of the Fed are also that we're below. They have a target rate for inflation, too. The Fed is supposed to be keeping the inflation rate as close to 2% as they can. They've got this dual mandate, one of which is, you know, economic and employment and all the other stuff. The other is related to inflation. And inflation is actually too low, according to those things. But they've been concentrating on the other half of their mandate. Anyway, my turn. I finished a TV show. Although it wasn't really a whole TV show, I purchased on iTunes a sort of Best of Carson highlights thing from Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. It had the last few episodes of the show. It had sort of a best of 60s, 70s, 80s. And then it had a bunch of edited down individual episodes from, you know, the whole span of Carson's Tonight Show. And I really enjoyed the ones that were highlights. The sort of last few episodes were really cool to see of his show, and the highlights of each decade were funny, although I'd seen most of those clips before. The individual episodes, you could pretty much skip those. I mean, they were edited down from 1 hour shows to half hour And, you know, you could see more how sort of spotty things were. I mean, they were picked as good episodes and they were kind of good, but, you can't live up to the highlights where you're actually taking the best moments of like 30 years of television and condensing them all together. The individual episodes just weren't as good. So I enjoyed watching it. I probably could have stopped after the ones that were, you know, the highlights of the whole career essentially, but it was fun. And, you know, it reminded me of when I was a kid, when I would stay up late and watch those. So,
I know. I was the same way. It's like you really felt special when you could stay up and watch the Tonight Show early or late at night.
Exactly. And so, like, you know, especially
because after that show was over, the stations shut down. They would show the test signal, and then it would just they'd go off the air.
Or a little bit totally later. After Letterman, after he came on as well. But but I certainly remember many nights when I was young, sort of staying up, watching Carson, watching Letterman, then watching those test signals and the station go off the air, and then knowing, okay, now maybe I really should go to bed. certainly for anyone who's actually old enough to remember Carson and remember some of those things, it's really fun to watch those old clips. I would recommend it. For, you know, a kid today, like, I don't know, I watched one of those episodes with my almost 20-year-old daughter, and she was just like, yeah, whatever, don't show me this stuff from the 70s, you know. Anyway, yeah. your turn again.
Okay, last topic for me would be two things, actually. Okay. The Pope is visiting, and the Chinese president, or whatever, Chinese premier, or whatever, is also visiting the country right now. And I think there's supposed to be a state dinner with the Chinese president. And I think, and today, Obama and Pope are having some joint appearances. And this Pope is very popular. Mm-hmm. He's very out there. I see a lot of Facebook posts of showing how the Pope will take selfies with people.
Right.
And I saw this one quick video of him stopping his motorcade to go out and give his blessing to a person who has cerebral palsy. And I must say, I'm not a Catholic, but it was quite touching to see how much love and affection he had for a person in need. So.
Yeah, and you know, I think you nailed it there with, you know, his appeal is not just Catholics. He's very popular in general. I see a lot of people posting about the Pope and the things the Pope is saying or doing who are most definitely not Catholics themselves. I mean, he's popular within certain streams of Catholics as well, of course, but there are a lot of non-Catholics who have been impressed with this Pope in various ways. Now, you know, as people have said, you know, he's not exactly a liberal either. He's not, you know, going around for gay marriage and abortion and things like this. But, you know, he's very different than previous popes.
But he is a liberal on some economic things.
He is a liberal on some economic things, and but he hasn't changed church doctrine in a lot of areas, but he's very much changing the approach of how he wants the church to interact with people, even who disagree with doctrine. And so he's making a lot of friends there. You know, like you said, he's a very popular figure right now. I don't think the Chinese president is getting the same kind of crowds as he goes around.
But the Chinese president did announce something like a purchase of like over 350 planes
from Boeing. So. Yeah. But meanwhile, he's clogging up the highways and keeping me from getting places I need to go.
Yes.
You know,
I've been working from home purposely just so I can avoid the traffic.
I work from home today because of that. Yesterday I had to go in and I timed it just wrong because I had to drop my kid off at school, and then I tried to go and they probably closed I-5 for his motorcade like 5 minutes before I tried to get on the exit.
Oh, man.
Because his plane touched down at Painfield, which is just a few miles from my house, at the same time I was dropping my kid off, and I dropped my kid off, and then I tried to go to work, and I got to the entrance to I-5, and the police officer was there with the cones, and I'm like, oh man, just now. Could you have waited 5 minutes? And so, of course, I ended up late to the meeting I was trying to get to as I tried to navigate around and get there through alternate routes that were all clogged as well. Oh, so fun. And I'm still deciding whether or not to work from home tomorrow for the same reasons, because the other thing about these road closures is they are trying to keep them as secret as possible for security reasons. So they're not, you don't have pre-announced times and places where the roads will be closed. They just happen. And then I've noticed even like some of the official traffic outlets, you know, aren't allowed to say, so you have others that are saying it anyway, but, it's just a mess. It's just a mess.
Wow. He's here for tomorrow too.
I think tomorrow's the last day. He was here 3 days, Tuesday,
wow,
Wednesday, Thursday.
That's amazing.
And then he goes east. I guess he's here for the UN meeting or whatever, in New York. Okay. I have one last thing and then we'll close it up. I would be remiss if I didn't mention, the kid who got harassed by the police for the clock in Texas that he brought to school.
Oh, yeah.
Now, there are a couple interesting things, of course. First of all, I absolutely agree with everything that everybody has said about, you know, the overreaction and, oh my, really, you know, the kid brings in something that he's made and your first assumption is, oh my God, it must be a bomb, or he's trying to do a hoax bomb or whatever, and you call the police and you give him the Inquisition and you have him let off in handcuffs, when clearly, by the way, no one actually believed it was a bomb, because if you actually believed it was a bomb, you'd get everybody the hell away from it. You'd get people out of the school. You'd do all the things you do. I mean, I remember when I was in school, when people would call in bomb threats and everybody would have to go outside and wait in line, just like you do in a fire drill. And they'd bring in the bomb squad or whatever and the sniffer dogs, and they'd make sure the coast was clear. And then you'd all go back in because it was just some kid who didn't want to do their algebra test calling in a bomb threat.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
You know, but they did none of that here. None of that whatsoever. The device in question was on the table while he was being questioned, you know, the whole thing. And so it's just crazy overreaction. And I think the people very much have a point when they say that, you know, this same type of reaction probably would not have happened if it was a white kid. Instead, it is a Muslim of African descent. So he's darker skinned and Muslim and has a Muslim name. And so, of course, everybody's like, ah, it must be a bomb, must be terrorism. And, you know, they harass the kid. And apparently the community has been known for, you know, anti-Muslim things, you know, Muslims in the community being harassed in various ways. So I think this is all absolutely ridiculous, and the police department there and the school system there deserve every ounce of criticism that they've gotten. But I will say one other thing.
No.
it has turned out, if you look into the, you know, he's gotten invites to all these tech schools and the White House and tech companies. I'm not sure he deserves all that. And because the reason is, it turns out like a couple of people have analyzed the pictures of his actual device. It doesn't look like it was all sort of put together as he invented his own clock, etc. It looks like what he actually did is he took apart a 1970s Radio Shack clock and just put it in a different case. So he's been presented as this sort of genius who was able to invent his own clock and do all this kind of stuff. And that's kind of overblown. It appears that that's not what he's done. I mean, it's fairly easy to take apart one of these old clocks and just, you know, put the components differently in a different orientation. So basically what he did is he took apart the clock, he put it in a pencil case instead of the regular case it was in, and spread the wires and connectors apart a little bit. And that appears to be what he actually did here. At least I've heard a couple people make that case. I have not done that analysis myself, so maybe that's wrong. Maybe he did do something inventive.
Yeah, but I have seen some of that, and including Sarah Palin even was saying how it kind of looked like a bomb. And,
well, yeah, I wasn't even going to bring those folks up who were like, yeah, it does look like a bomb. Come on. No, it doesn't look like a bomb. It looks like somebody took apart a clock, but it also brings up sort of the technological illiteracy of people who see a circuit board and, oh, my God, it's a circuit board. It must be nefarious. It must be awful. They're wires. Oh, my God, they're wires, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, come on, you know, there's... Every piece of technology we carry around and stuff has more sophisticated electronics than this kind of stuff. And, you know, maybe we can't expect the Texas English teacher to look at that and know instantly, oh, it's just a clock. But, you know, certainly there are a bunch of people around there who could, you know, sort of potentially validated. Apparently the first person he showed it to was an engineering teacher and was like, oh yeah, that's cool. Don't show it to anybody else. So you already had people at the school who knew it was harmless. And you also have the question of, well, do you give the benefit of the doubt? And I understand sort of this atmosphere of fear that's everywhere, but that's something we should be fighting against. And again, the question is, you know, if it was the, you know, blonde-haired, blue-eyed teacher's pet who brought this in, would they be saying anything different? And I think the answer, unfortunately, is yes. They would not have done this. And I think it also is an incredible indictment that, you know, that they didn't act like it really was a bomb. So they knew it wasn't a bomb from the beginning. You know, like I said, I think the school system, the police, everybody there did an incredible disservice. They handled this incredibly badly. But at the same time, you know, all of this stuff that's hailing this guy as like genius inventor kid. Okay, maybe not so much. But regardless, he may not be a genius inventor kid, but he was, you know, geek kid doing something that he thought was cool, showing it to his teacher. And that should not be an incident for arrest, even if you have a Muslim name.
Yeah, totally agree.
Okay, I think that's it. Unless you have anything to wrap up with, Bruce.
Nope, that's it.
Well,
a lot of fun.
Well, thank you, everybody. Well, first of all, thank you, Bruce, for joining us again. And thanks to everybody listening. We appreciate it. Like us on Facebook, share us on Facebook, and go there to comment and tell us what you thought of the show. We always appreciate it. And in the meantime, you know, tune in next week and have a great week yourself. We'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks again, Bruce. We'll talk to you next time.
All right. Good night.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.